Chapter 11. Maslova and Her Companions. The political prisoners were kept in two small rooms, the doors of which opened into a part of the passage partitioned off from the rest. The first person Nekhludov saw on entering into this part of the passage was Simonson, in his rubber jacket and with a log of pine wood in his hands, crouching in front of a stove, the door of which trembled, drawn in by the heat inside. When he saw Nekhludov, he looked up at him from under his protruding brow and gave him his hand without rising.
"I am glad you have come. I want to speak to you," he said, looking Nekhludov straight in the eyes with an expression of importance.
"Yes, what is it?" Nekhludov asked.
"It will do later on. I'm busy just now."
And Simonson turned again towards the stove, which he was heating according to a theory of his own, so as to lose as little heat energy as possible. Nekhludov was going to enter in at the first door when Maslova, stooping and pushing a large heap of rubbish and dust towards the stove with a handleless birch broom, came out of the other. She had a white jacket on, her skirt was tucked up, and a kerchief, drawn down to her eyebrows, protected her hair from the dust. When she saw Nekhludov, she drew herself up, flushing and animated, put down the broom, wiped her hands on her skirt, and stopped right in front of him.
"You are tidying up the apartments, I see," said Nekhludov, shaking hands.
"Yes, my old occupation,"
and she smiled.
"But the dirt! You can't imagine what it is. We've been cleaning and cleaning."
"Well, is the plaid dry?"
she asked, turning to Simonson.
"Almost,"
Simonson answered, giving her a strange look, which struck Nekhludov.
"All right, I'll come for it, and we'll bring the cloaks to dry. Our people are all in here,"
she said to Nekhludov, pointing to the first door as she went out of the second.
Nekhludov opened the door and entered a small room dimly lit by a little metal lamp, which was standing low down on the shelf bedstead. It was cold in the room, and there was a smell of the dust, which had not had time to settle, damp and tobacco smoke. Only those who were close to the lamp were clearly visible. The bedsteads were in the shade, and wavering shadows glided over the walls. Two men, appointed as caterers, who had gone to fetch boiling water and provisions, were away. Most of the political prisoners were gathered together in the small room. There was Nekhludov's old acquaintance, Vera Dukhova, with her large, frightened eyes and a swollen vein on her forehead, in a grey jacket with short hair and thinner and yellower than ever. She had a newspaper spread out in front of her, and sat rolling cigarettes with a jerky movement of her hands. Emily Rintzeva, whom Nekhludov considered to be the pleasantest of the political prisoners, was also here. She looked after the housekeeping, and managed to spread a feeling of home comfort even in the midst of the most trying surroundings. She sat beside the lamp with her sleeves rolled up, wiping cups and mugs, and placing them with her deft, red and sunburnt hands on a cloth that was spread on the bedstead. Rintzeva was a plain-looking young woman, with a clever and mild expression of face which, when she smiled, had a way of suddenly becoming merry, animated, and captivating. It was with such a smile that she now welcomed Nekhludov.
"Why, we thought you'd gone back to Russia," she said.
Here in a dark corner was also Mary Pavlovna, busy with a little fair-haired girl who kept prattling in her sweet, childish accents.
"How nice that you have come," she said to Nekhludov. "Have you seen Katyusha? And we have a visitor here."
And she pointed to the little girl. Here was also Anatoly Kruzov, with felt boots on, sitting in a far corner with his feet under him, doubled up and shivering, his arms folded in the sleeves of his cloak, and looking at Nekhludov with feverish eyes. Nekhludov was going up to him, but to the right of the door a man with spectacles and reddish curls, dressed in a rubber jacket, sat talking to the pretty, smiling Grabets. This was the celebrated revolutionist, Novodvorov. Nekhludov hastened to greet him. He was in a particular hurry about it, because this man was the only one among all the political prisoners whom he disliked. Novodvorov's eyes glistened through his spectacles as he looked at Nekhludov and held his narrow hand out to him.
"Well, are you having a pleasant journey?" he asked, with apparent irony.
"Yes, there is much that is interesting," Nekhludov answered, as if he did not notice the irony, but took the question for politeness, and passed on to Kruzov. Though Nekhludov appeared indifferent,
He was really far from indifferent, and these words of Novodvorov, showing his evident desire to say or do something unpleasant, interfered with the state of kindness in which Nekhludov found himself, and he felt depressed and sad. "Well, how are you?" he asked, pressing Kryltsov's cold and trembling hand.
"Pretty well, only I cannot get warm. I got wet through," Kryltsov answered, quickly replacing his hands into the sleeves of his cloak. "And here it is also beastly cold. There, look, the window panes are broken."
And he pointed to the broken panes behind the iron bars.
"And how are you? Why did you not come?"
"I was not allowed to. The authorities were so strict. But today the officer is lenient."
"Lenient, indeed," Kryltsov remarked. "Ask Mary what she did this morning."
Mary Pavlovna, from her place in the corner, related what had happened about the little girl that morning when they left the halting station.
"I think it is absolutely necessary to make a collective protest," said Vera Dukhova, in a determined tone, and yet looking now at one, now at another, with a frightened, undecided look.
"Valdemar Simonson did protest, but that is not sufficient."
"What protest?"
muttered Kryltsov, cross and frowning. Her want of simplicity, artificial tone, and nervousness had evidently been irritating him for a long time.
"Are you looking for Katyusha?" he asked, addressing Nekhludov. "She is working all the time. She has cleaned this, the men's room, and now she has gone to clean the women's. Only it is not possible to clean away the fleas. And what is Mary doing there?" he asked, nodding towards the corner where Mary Pavlovna sat.
"She is combing out her adopted daughter's hair," replied Rintzeva.
"But won't she let the insects loose on us?" asked Kryltsov.
"No, no, I'm very careful. She is a clean little girl now. You take her," said Mary, turning to Rintzeva, "while I go and help Katyusha, and I will also bring him his plaid."
Rintzeva took the little girl on her lap, pressing her plump, bare little arms to her bosom with a mother's tenderness, and gave her a bit of sugar. As Mary Pavlovna left the room, two men came in with boiling water and provisions. Chapter 12. Nabatov and Markel. One of the men who came in was a short, thin young man who had a cloth-covered sheepskin coat on and high top boots. He stepped lightly and quickly, carrying two steaming pots and holding a loaf wrapped in a cloth under his arm.
"Well, so our prince has put in an appearance again," he said as he placed the teapot beside the cups and handed the bread to Rintzeva. "We have bought wonderful things," he continued as he took off his sheepskin and flung it over the heads of the others into the corner of the bedstead. "Markel has bought milk and eggs. Why, we'll have a regular ball today, and Rintzeva is spreading out her aesthetic cleanliness," he said, and looked with a smile at Rintzeva. "And now she will make the tea."
The whole presence of this man, his motion, his voice, his look, seemed to breathe vigour and merriment. The other newcomer was just the reverse of the first. He looked despondent and sad. He was short, bony, had very prominent cheekbones, a sallow complexion, thin lips, and beautiful greenish eyes, rather far apart. He wore an old wadded coat, top boots, and galoshes, and was carrying two pots of milk and two round boxes made of birch bark, which he placed in front of Rintzeva. He bowed to Nekhludov, bending only his neck and with his eyes fixed on him. Then, having reluctantly given him his damp hand to shake, he began to take out the provisions. Both these political prisoners were of the people. The first was Nabatov, a peasant. The second, Markel Kondratyev, a factory hand. Markel did not come among the revolutionists till he was quite a man, Nabatov only 18. After leaving the village school, owing to his exceptional talents, Nabatov entered the gymnasium and maintained himself by giving lessons all the time he studied there, and obtained the gold medal. He did not go to the university because, while still in the 7th class of the gymnasium, he made up his mind to go among the people and enlighten his neglected brethren. This he did, first getting the place of a government clerk in a large village. He was soon arrested because he read to the peasants and arranged a cooperative industrial association among them. They kept him in prison for 8 months and then set him free, but he remained under police supervision. As soon as he was liberated, he went to another village, got a place as schoolmaster, and did the same as he had done in the first village. He was again taken up and kept 14 months in prison, where his convictions became yet stronger. After that he was exiled to the Perm government, from where he escaped. Then he was put to prison for 7 months, and after that exiled to Archangel. There he refused to take the oath of allegiance that was required of them, and was condemned to be exiled to the Takutsk government, so that half his life since he reached manhood was passed in prison and exile. All these adventures did not embitter him, nor weaken his energy, but rather stimulated it. He was a lively young fellow, with a splendid digestion, always active, gay, and vigorous. He never repented of anything, never looked far ahead, and used all his powers, his cleverness, his practical knowledge, to act in the present. When free, he worked towards the aim he had set himself, the enlightening and the uniting of the working men, especially the country labourers. When in prison, he was just as energetic and practical in finding means to come in contact with the outer world, and in arranging his own life and the life of his group as comfortably as the conditions would allow. Above all things, he was a communist. He wanted, as it seemed to him, nothing for himself, and contented himself with very little, but demanded very much for the group of his comrades, and could work for it either physically or mentally, day and night, without sleep or food. As a peasant he had been industrious, observant, clever at his work, and naturally self-controlled, polite without any effort, and attentive not only to the wishes but also the opinions of others. His widowed mother, an illiterate, superstitious old peasant woman, was still living, and Nabatov helped her and went to see her while he was free. During the time he spent at home, he entered into all the interests of his mother's life, helped her in her work, and continued his intercourse with former playfellows, smoked cheap tobacco with them in so-called dog's feet, a kind of cigarette that the peasants smoke, made of a bit of paper and bent at one end into a hook, took part in their fist-fights, and explained to them how they were all being deceived by the state, and how they ought to disentangle themselves out of the deception they were kept in. When he thought or spoke of what a revolution would do for the people, he always imagined this people from whom he had sprung himself, left in very nearly the same conditions as they were in, only with sufficient land, and without the gentry and without officials. The revolution, according to him, and in this he differed from Novodvorov and Novodvorov's follower, Markel Kondratyev, should not alter the elementary forms of the life of the people, should not break down the whole edifice, but should only alter the inner walls of the beautiful, strong, enormous old structure he loved so dearly. He was also a typical peasant in his views on religion, never thinking about metaphysical questions, about the origin of all origin or the future life. God was to him, as also to Arago, an hypothesis, which he had had no need of up to now. He had no business with the origin of the world, whether Moses or Darwin was right. Darwinism, which seemed so important to his fellows, was only the same kind of plaything of the mind as the creation in 6 days. The question how the world had originated did not interest him, just because the question how it would be best to live in this world was ever before him. He never thought about future life, always bearing in the depth of his soul the firm and quiet conviction inherited from his forefathers, and common to all labourers on the land, that just as in the world of plants and animals nothing ceases to exist but continually changes its form, the manure into grain, the grain into a food, the tadpole into a frog, the caterpillar into a butterfly, the acorn into an oak, so man also does not perish, but only undergoes a change. He believed in this, and therefore always looked death straight in the face, and bravely bore the sufferings that lead towards it, but did not care, and did not know how to speak about it. He loved work, was always employed in some practical business, and put his comrades in the way of the same kind of practical work. The other political prisoner from among the people, Markel Kondratyev, was a very different kind of man. He began to work at the age of 15, and took to smoking and drinking in order to stifle a dense sense of being wronged. He first realized he was wronged one Christmas, when they, the factory children, were invited to a Christmas tree got up by the employer's wife, where he received a farthing whistle, an apple, a gilt walnut, and a fig, while the employer's children had presents given them which seemed gifts from fairyland, and had cost more than 50 rubles, as he afterwards heard. When he was 20, a celebrated revolutionist came to their factory to work as a working girl, and noticing his superior qualities, began giving books and pamphlets to Kondratiev, and to talk and explain his position to him, and how to remedy it. When the possibility of freeing himself and others from their oppressed state rose clearly in his mind, the injustice of this state appeared more cruel and more terrible than before, and he longed passionately not only for freedom, but also for the punishment of those who had arranged and who kept up this cruel injustice. Kondratiev devoted himself with passion to the acquirement of knowledge. It was not clear to him how knowledge should bring about the realization of the social ideal, but he believed that the knowledge that had shown him the injustice of the state in which he lived would also abolish that injustice itself. Besides, knowledge would, in his opinion, raise him above others. Therefore he left off drinking and smoking, and devoted all his leisure time to study. The revolutionist gave him lessons, and his thirst for every kind of knowledge, and the facility with which he took it in, surprised her. In 2 years he had mastered algebra, geometry, history, which he was specially fond of, and made acquaintance with artistic and critical, and especially socialistic, literature. The revolutionist was arrested, and Kondratiev with her, forbidden books having been found in their possession, and they were imprisoned and then exiled to the Vologda government. There Kondratiev became acquainted with Novodvorov, and read a great deal more revolutionary literature, remembered it all, and became still firmer in his socialistic views. While in exile he became leader in a large strike, which ended in the destruction of a factory and the murder of the director. He was again arrested and condemned to Siberia. His religious views were of the same negative nature as his views of the existing economic conditions. Having seen the absurdity of the religion in which he was brought up, and having gained with great effort, and at first with fear, but later with rapture, freedom from it, he did not tire of viciously and with venom ridiculing priests and religious dogmas, as if wishing to revenge himself for the deception that had been practised on him. He was ascetic through habit, contented himself with very little, and, like all those used to work from childhood and whose muscles have been developed, he could work much and easily, and was quick at any manual labour. But what he valued most was the leisure in prisons and halting stations, which enabled him to continue his studies. He was now studying the first volume of Karl Marx's, and carefully hid the book in his sack, as if it were a great treasure. He behaved with reserve and indifference to all his comrades, except Novodvorov, to whom he was greatly attached, and whose arguments on all subjects he accepted as unanswerable truths. He had an indefinite contempt for women whom he looked upon as a hindrance in all necessary business, but he pitied Maslova and was gentle with her, for he considered her an example of the way the lower are exploited by the upper classes. The same reason made him dislike Nekhludov, so that he talked little with him and never pressed Nekhludov's hand, but only held out his own to be pressed when greeting him. Chapter 13. Love Affairs of the Exiles. The stove had burned up and got warm. The tea was made and poured out into mugs and cups, and milk was added to it. Rusks, fresh rye and wheat bread, hard-boiled eggs, butter and calf's head and feet were placed on the cloth. Everybody moved towards the part of the shelf beds which took the place of the table, and sat eating and talking. Rintseva sat on a box, pouring out the tea. The rest crowded round her. Only Kryltsov, who had taken off his wet cloak and wrapped himself in his dry plaid and lay in his own place, talking to Nekhludov. After the cold and damp march, and the dirt and disorder they had found here, and after the pains they had taken to get it tidy after having drunk hot tea and eaten, they were all in the best and brightest of spirits. The fact that the tramp of feet, the screams and abuse of the criminals, reached them through the wall, reminding them of their surroundings, seemed only to increase the sense of cosiness. As on an island in the midst of the sea, these people felt themselves, for a brief interval, not swamped by the degradation and sufferings which surrounded them. This made their spirits rise and excited them. They talked about everything except their present position and that which awaited them, Then, as it generally happens among young men, and women especially, if they are forced to remain together, as these people were, all sorts of agreements and disagreements and attractions curiously blended had sprung up among them. Almost all of them were in love. Novodvorov was in love with a pretty, smiling Grabets. This Grabets was a young and thoughtless girl who had gone in for a course of study, perfectly indifferent to revolutionary questions, but succumbing to the influence of the day, she compromised herself in some way, and was exiled. The chief interest of her life during the time of her trial in prison and in exile was her success with men, just as it had been when she was free. Now, on the way, she comforted herself with the fact that Novodvorov had taken a fancy to her, and she fell in love with him. Vera Dukhova, who was very prone to fall in love herself, but did not awaken love in others, though she was always hoping for mutual love, was sometimes drawn to Nabatov, then to Novodvorov. Kryltsov felt something like love for Mary Pavlovna. He loved her with a man's love, but knowing how she regarded this sort of love, hid his feelings under the guise of friendship and gratitude for the tenderness with which she attended to his wants. Nabatov and Rintseva were attached to each other by very complicated ties. Just as Mary Pavlovna was a perfectly chaste maiden, in the same way Rintseva was perfectly chaste as her own husband's wife. When only a schoolgirl of 16, she fell in love with Rintsev, a student of the Petersburg University, and married him before he left the university when she was only 19 years old. During his fourth year at the university, her husband had become involved in the students' rows, was exiled from Petersburg, and turned revolutionist. She left the medical courses she was attending, followed him, and also turned revolutionist. If she had not considered her husband the cleverest and best of men, she would not have fallen in love with him, and if she had not fallen in love, would not have married. But having fallen in love and married him whom she thought the best and cleverest of men, she naturally looked upon life and its aims in the way the best and cleverest of men looked at them. At first he thought the aim of life was to learn, and she looked upon study as the aim of life. He became a revolutionist, and so did she. She could demonstrate very clearly that the existing state of things could not go on, and that it was everybody's duty to fight this state of things, and to try to bring about conditions in which the individual could develop freely, etc. And she imagined that she really thought and felt all this, but in reality she only regarded everything her husband thought as absolute truth, and only sought for perfect agreement, perfect identification of her own soul with his, which alone could give her full moral satisfaction. The parting with her husband and their child, whom her mother had taken, was very hard to bear, but she bore it firmly and quietly, since it was for her husband's sake and for that cause which she had not the slightest doubt was true, since he served it. She was always with her husband in thoughts, and did not love and could not love any other any more than she had done before. But Nabatov's devoted and pure love touched and excited her. This moral, firm man, her husband's friend, tried to treat her as a sister, but something more appeared in his behaviour to her, and this something frightened them both, and yet gave colour to their life of hardship. So that in all this circle only Mary Pavlovna and Kondratyev were quite free from love affairs. Chapter 14. Conversations in Prison. Expecting to have a private talk with Katyusha, as usual, after tea, Nekhludov sat by the side of Kryltsov, conversing with him. Among other things, he told him the story of Makar's crime, and about his request to him. Kryltsov listened attentively, gazing at Nekhludov with glistening eyes. "Yes," said Kryltsov suddenly, "I often think that here we are going side by side with them, and who are they? The same for whose sake we are going, and yet we not only do not know them, but do not even wish to know them. And they, even worse than that, they hate us, and look upon us as enemies. This is terrible."
"There is nothing terrible about it," broke in Novodvorov. "The masses always worship power only. The government is in power, and they worship it and hate us. Tomorrow we shall have the power, and they will worship us," he said with his grating voice.
At that moment a volley of abuse and the rattle of chains sounded from behind the wall. Something was heard thumping against it, and screaming and shrieking. Someone was being beaten, and someone was calling out, "Murder! Help!"
"Hear them, the beasts," "'What intercourse can there be between us and such as them?'
quietly remarked Novodvorov.
"'You call them beasts, and Yekludov was just telling me about such an action,'
irritably retorted Kryltsov, and went on to say how Makar was risking his life to save a fellow villager.
"'That is not the action of a beast, it is heroism.'
"'Sentimentality,'
Novodvorov ejaculated ironically.
"'It is difficult for us to understand the emotions of these people and the motives on which they act. You see generosity in the act, and it may be simply jealousy of that other criminal.'
"'How is it that you never wish to see anything good in another?'
Mary Pavlovna said suddenly, flaring up.
"'How can one see what does not exist?'
"'How does it not exist when a man risks dying a terrible death?'
"'I think,' said Novodvorov, "'that if we mean to do our work, the first condition is that—'
Here Kondratiev put down the book he was reading by the lamplight and began to listen attentively to his master's words.
"'We should not give way to fancy, but look at things as they are. We should do all in our power for the masses and expect nothing in return. The masses can only be the object of our activity, but cannot be our fellow workers as long as they remain in that state of inertia they are in at present.'
He went on, as if delivering a lecture.
Therefore, to expect help from them before the process of development, that process which we are preparing them for, has taken place, is an illusion.
What process of development? Kryltsov began, flushing all over. We say that we are against arbitrary rule and despotism, and is this not the most awful despotism?
No despotism whatever,
quietly rejoined Novodvorov.
I am only saying that I know the path that the people must travel, and can show them that path.
But how can you be sure that the path you show is the true path? Is this not the same kind of despotism that lay at the bottom of the Inquisition, all persecutions, and the Great Revolution? They, too, knew the one true way, by means of their science.
Their having erred is no proof of my going to err. Besides, there is a great difference between the ravings of ideologues and the facts based on sound economic science.
Novodvorov's voice filled the room. He alone was speaking. All the rest were silent.
They are always disputing, Mary Pavlovna said, when there was a moment's silence.
And you yourself, what do you think about it? Nekludov asked her.
I think Kryltsov is right when he says we should not force our views on the people.
And you, Katyusha? Asked Nekludov with a smile, waiting anxiously for her answer, fearing she would say something awkward.
"'I think the common people are wronged,' she said, and blushed scarlet. "'I think they are dreadfully wronged.'
"'That's right, Maslova, quite right,' cried Nabatov. "'They are terribly wronged, the people, and they must not be wronged, and therein lies the whole of our task.'
"'A curious idea of the object of revolution,'
Novodvorov remarked crossly, and began to smoke.
"'I cannot talk to him,' said Kryltsov, in a whisper, and was silent.
"'And it is much better not to talk,' Nekludov said. Chapter 15. Novodvorov. Although Novodvorov was highly esteemed of all the revolutionists, though he was very learned and considered very wise, Nekludov reckoned him among those of the revolutionists who, being below the average moral level, were very far below it. His inner life was of a nature directly opposite to that of Simonson's. Simonson was one of those people, of an essentially masculine type, whose actions follow the dictates of their reason and are determined by it. Novodvorov belonged, on the contrary, to the class of people of a feminine type whose reason is directed partly towards the attainment of aims set by their feelings, partly to the justification of acts suggested by their feelings. The whole of Novodvorov's revolutionary activity, though he could explain it very eloquently and very convincingly, appeared to Nekludov to be founded on nothing but ambition and the desire for supremacy. At first, his capacity for assimilating the thoughts of others, and of expressing them correctly, had given him a position of supremacy among pupils and teachers in the gymnasium and the university, where qualities such as his are highly prized, and he was satisfied. When he had finished his studies and received his diploma, he suddenly altered his views, and from a modern liberal he turned into a rabid narodnyovolets, in order, so Kryltsov, who did not like him, said, to gain supremacy in another sphere. as he was devoid of those moral and aesthetic qualities which call forth doubts and hesitation, he very soon acquired a position in the revolutionary world which satisfied him, that of the leader of a party. Having once chosen a direction, he never doubted or hesitated, and was therefore certain that he never made a mistake. Everything seemed quite simple, clear, and certain, and the narrowness and one-sidedness of his views did make everything seem simple and clear. One only had to be logical, as he said. His self-assurance was so great that it either repelled people or made them submit to him. As he carried on his work among very young people, his boundless self-assurance led them to believe him very profound and wise. The majority did submit to him, and he had a great success in revolutionary circles. His activity was directed to the preparation of a rising in which he was to usurp the power and call together a council. A program, composed by him, should be proposed before the council, and he felt sure that this program of his solved every problem, and that it would be impossible not to carry it out. His comrades respected, but did not love him. He did not love anyone, looked upon all men of note as upon rivals, and would have willingly treated them as old male monkeys treat young ones if he could have done it. He would have torn all mental power, every capacity, from other men, so that they should not interfere with the display of his talents. He behaved well only to those who bowed before him. Now, on the journey, he behaved well to Kondratyev, who was influenced by his propaganda, to Vera Dukhova and pretty little Grabitz, who were both in love with him. Although in principle he was in favour of the woman's movement, yet in the depth of his soul he considered all women stupid and insignificant, except those whom he was sentimentally in love with, as he was now in love with Grabitz, and such women he considered to be exceptions, whose merits he alone was capable of discerning. The question of the relations of the sexes he also looked upon as thoroughly solved by accepting free union. He had one nominal and one real wife, from both of whom he was separated, having come to the conclusion that there was no real love between them. And now he thought of entering on a free union with Grabitz. He despised Nekhludov for playing the fool, as Novodvorov termed it, with Maslova, but especially for the freedom Nekhludov took of considering the defects of the existing system and the methods of correcting those defects in a manner which was not only not exactly the same as Novodvorov's, but was Nekhludov's own, a prince's, that is, a fool's manner. Nekhludov felt this relation of Novodvorov's towards him, and knew to his sorrow that in spite of the state of goodwill in which he found himself on this journey, he could not help paying this man in his own coin, and could not stifle the strong antipathy he felt for him. Chapter 16. Simonson speaks to Nekhludov. The voices of officials sounded from the next room. All the prisoners were silent, and a sergeant, followed by two convoy soldiers, entered. The time of the inspection had come. The sergeant counted everyone, and when Nekhludov's turn came, he addressed him with kindly familiarity.
"You must not stay any longer, Prince, after the inspection. You must go now."
Nekhludov knew what this meant, went up to the sergeant and shoved a 3-ruble note into his hand.
"Ah, well, what is one to do with you? Stay a bit longer, if you like."
The sergeant was about to go when another sergeant, followed by a convict, a spare man with a thin beard and a bruise under his eye, came in.
"It's about the girl I've come," said the convict.
"Here's Daddy come,"
came the ringing accents of a child's voice, and a flaxen head appeared from behind Rintzeva, who, with Katyusha's and Mary Pavlovna's help, was making a new garment for the child out of one of Rintzeva's own petticoats.
"Yes, daughter, it's me."
Busovkin, the prisoner, said softly.
"She is quite comfortable here," said Mary Pavlovna, looking with pity at Busovkin's bruised face. "Leave her with us." "The ladies are making me new clothes," said the girl, pointing to Rintzeva's sewing. "Nice red ones," she went on, prattling. "Do you wish to sleep with us?" asked Rintzeva, caressing the child. "Yes, I wish. And Daddy, too." "No, Daddy can't. We'll leave her, then," she said, turning to the father.
"Yes, you may leave her," said the first sergeant, and went out with the other.
As soon as they were out of the room, Nabatov went up to Busovkin, slapped him on the shoulder, and said,
"I say, old fellow, is it true that Karmanov wishes to exchange?"
Busovkin's kindly, gentle face turned suddenly sad, and a veil seemed to dim his eyes.
"'We have heard nothing, hardly,' he said,
and with the same dimness still over his eyes he turned to the child.
"'Well, Aksutka, it seems you're to make yourself comfortable with the ladies.'
And he hurried away.
"'It's true about the exchange, and he knows it very well,' said Nabatov. "'What are you going to do?'
"'I shall tell the authorities in the next town. I know both prisoners by sight,' said Nekludov. All were silent, fearing a recommencement of the dispute. Simonson, who had been lying with his arms thrown back behind his head and not speaking, rose and determinately walked up to Nekludov, carefully passing round those who were sitting.
"'Could you listen to me now?'
"'Of course,' and Nekludov rose and followed him. Katyusha looked up with an expression of suspense, and meeting Nekludov's eyes, she blushed and shook her head.
"'What I want to speak to you about is this,'
Simonson began, when they had come out into the passage. In the passage the din of the criminals' voices and shouts sounded louder. Nekludov made a face, but Simonson did not seem to take any notice.
"'Knowing of your relations to Katerina Maslova,'
he began seriously and frankly, with his kind eyes looking straight into Nekludov's face,
"'I consider it my duty—'
He was obliged to stop, because two voices were heard disputing and shouting, both at once, close to the door.
"'I tell you, blockhead, they're not mine!'
one voice shouted.
"'May you choke, you devil!'
snorted the other. At this moment Mary Pavlovna came out into the passage.
"'How can one talk here?' she said. "'Go in, Vera is alone there.'
And she went in at the second door and entered a tiny room, evidently meant for a solitary cell, which was now placed at the disposal of the political women prisoners. Vera Dukhova lay covered up, head and all, on the bed.
"'She has got a headache and is asleep, so she cannot hear you, and I will go away,' said Mary Pavlovna.
"'On the contrary, stay here,' said Simonson. "'I have no secrets from anyone, certainly none from you.'
"'All right,' said Mary Pavlovna,
and moving her whole body from side to side like a child so as to get farther back onto the bed, she settled down to listen, her beautiful hazel eyes seeming to look somewhere far away.
"'Well, then, this is my business,' Simonson repeated. "'Knowing of your relations to Katerina Maslova, I consider myself bound to explain to you my relations to her.'
Nekludov could not help admiring the simplicity and truthfulness with which Simonson spoke to him.
"'What do you mean?'
"'I mean that I should like to marry Katerina Maslova.'
"'How strange,' said Mary Pavlovna, fixing her eyes on Simonson.
"'And so I made up my mind to ask her to be my wife,'
Simonson continued.
"'What can I do? It depends on her,'
said Nekludov.
"'Yes, but she will not come to any decision without you.'
"'Why?
Because as long as your relations with her are unsettled, she cannot make up her mind.'
"'As far as I'm concerned, it is finally settled. I should like to do what I consider to be my duty and also to lighten her fate, but on no account would I wish to put any restraint on her.'
"'Yes, but she does not wish to accept your sacrifice.'
"'It is no sacrifice.
And I know that this decision of hers is final.'
"'Well, then, there is no need to speak to me,' said Nekludov.
"'She wants you to acknowledge that you think as she does.'
"'How can I acknowledge that I must not do what I consider to be my duty? All I can say is that I am not free, but she is.'
Simonson was silent. Then, after thinking a little, he said,
"'Very well, then, I'll tell her. You must not think I am in love with her,' he continued. "'I love her as a splendid, unique human being who has suffered much. I want nothing from her. I have only an awful longing to help her, to lighten her position—'
Nekludov was surprised to hear the trembling in Simonson's voice.
"'To lighten her position,' Simonson continued. "'If she does not wish to accept your help, let her accept mine. If she consents, I shall ask to be sent to the place where she will be imprisoned. 4 years are not an eternity.' "'I would live near her, and perhaps might lighten her fate.'
And he again stopped, too agitated to continue. "'What am I to say?' said Nekludov. "'I am very glad she has found such a protector as you.'
"'That's what I wanted to know,'
Simonson interrupted.
"'I wanted to know if, loving her and wishing her happiness, you would consider it good for her to marry me.'
"'Oh, yes,' said Nekludov decidedly.
It all depends on her. I only wish that this suffering soul should find rest," said Simonson, with such childlike tenderness as no one could have expected from so morose-looking a man. Simonson rose and, stretching his lips out to Nekhludov, smiled shyly and kissed him.
"So I shall tell her."
And he went away. Chapter 17. I Have Nothing More to Say.
"What do you think of that?" said Mary Pavlovna. "In love, quite in love. Now that's a thing I never should have expected, that Valdemar Simonson should be in love, and in the silliest, most boyish manner. It is strange, and, to say the truth, it is sad."
And she sighed. "But she, Katyusha, how does she look at it, do you think?" Nekhludov asked.
"She?"
Mary Pavlovna waited, evidently wishing to give as exact an answer as possible.
"She? Well, you see, in spite of her past, she has one of the most moral natures and such fine feelings. She loves you well, and is happy to be able to do you even the negative good of not letting you get entangled with her. Marriage with you would be a terrible fall for her, worse than all that's past, and therefore she will never consent to it. And yet your presence troubles her."
"Well, what am I to do? Ought I to vanish?"
Mary Pavlovna smiled her sweet, childlike smile and said, "Yes, partly."
"How is one to vanish partly?"
"I'm talking nonsense. But as for her, I should like to tell you that she probably sees the silliness of this rapturous kind of love. He has not spoken to her, and is both flattered and afraid of it. I'm not competent to judge in such affairs, you know. Still, I believe that on his part it is the most ordinary man's feeling, though it is masked. He says that this love arouses his energy and is platonic, but I know that even if it is exceptional, still at the bottom it is degrading."
Mary Pavlovna had wandered from the subject, having started on her favourite theme. "Well, but what am I to do?" Nekhludov asked.
"I think you should tell her everything. It is always best that everything should be clear. Have a talk with her. I shall call her, shall I?" said Mary Pavlovna.
"If you please," said Nekhludov, and Mary Pavlovna went. A strange feeling overcame Nekhludov when he was alone in the little room with the sleeping Vera Dukhova, listening to her soft breathing, broken now and then by moans, and to the incessant dirt that came through the two doors that separated him from the criminals. What Simonson had told him freed him from the self-imposed duty, which had seemed hard and strange to him in his weak moments, and yet now he felt something that was not merely unpleasant, but painful. He had a feeling that this offer of Simonson's destroyed the exceptional character of his sacrifice, and thereby lessened its value in his own and others' eyes. If so good a man who was not bound to her by any kind of tie wanted to join his fate to hers, then this sacrifice was not so great. There may have also been an admixture of ordinary jealousy. He had got so used to her love that he did not like to admit that she loved another. Then it also upset the plans he had formed of living near her while she was doing her term. If she married Simonson, his presence would be unnecessary, and he would have to form new plans. Before he had time to analyze his feelings, the loud din of the prisoners' voices came in with a rush. Something special was going on among them today, as the door opened to let Katyusha in. She stepped briskly close up to him and said,
"Mary Pavlovna has sent me."
"Yes, I must have a talk with you.
Sit down."
"Valdemar Simonson has been speaking to me." She sat down and folded her hands in her lap and seemed quite calm, but hardly had Nekhludov uttered Simonson's name when she flushed crimson.
"What did he say?"
she asked. "He told me he wanted to marry you." Her face suddenly puckered up with pain, but she said nothing and only cast down her eyes. "He is asking for my consent, or my advice. I told him that it all depends entirely on you, that you must decide."
"Oh, what does it all mean? Why?"
she muttered, and looked in his eyes with that peculiar squint that always strangely affected Nekhludov. They sat silent for a few minutes, looking into each other's eyes, and this look told much to both of them. "You must decide," Nekhludov repeated.
What am I to decide? Everything has long been decided.
No. You must decide whether you will accept Mr. Simonson's offer, said Nekhludoff.
What sort of a wife can I be? I, a convict. Why should I ruin Mr. Simonson too?
She said with a frown. Well, but if the sentence should be mitigated.
Oh, leave me alone. I have nothing more to say, she said, and rose to leave the room.
Chapter 18. Neverov's Fate. When, following Katyusha, Nekhludoff returned to the men's room, he found everyone there in agitation. Nabatov, who went about all over the place and who got to know everybody and noticed everything, had just brought news which staggered them all. The news was that he had discovered a note on a wall written by the revolutionist Pietlin, who had been sentenced to hard labour and who, everyone thought, had long since reached the Kara. And now it turned out that he had passed this way quite recently, the only political prisoner among criminal convicts. On the 17th of August, so ran the note, I was sent off alone with the criminals. Neverov was with me, but hanged himself in the lunatic asylum in Kazan. I am well and in good spirits and hope for the best. All were discussing Petlin's position and the possible reasons of Neverov's suicide. Only Kryltsov sat silent and preoccupied, his glistening eyes gazing fixedly in front of him.
My husband told me that Neverov had a vision while still in the Petropavlovsky prison, said Rintzeva.
Yes, he was a poet, a dreamer. This sort of people cannot stand solitary confinement, said Novodvorov. Now, I never gave my imagination vent when in solitary confinement, but arranged my days most systematically, and in this way always bore it very well.
What is there unbearable about it? Why, I used to be glad when they locked me up, said Nabatov cheerfully, wishing to dispel the general depression. A fellow's afraid of everything, of being arrested himself and entangling others, and of spoiling the whole business, and then he gets locked up and all responsibility is at an end, and he can rest. He can just sit and smoke.
You knew him well? Asked Mary Pavlovna, glancing anxiously at the altered, haggard expression of Kryltsov's face.
Neverov a dreamer?
Kryltsov suddenly began, panting for breath as if he had been shouting or singing for a long time.
Neverov was a man such as the earth bears few of, as our doorkeeper used to express it. Yes, he had a nature like crystal. You could see him right through. He could not lie. He could not dissemble. Not simply thin-skinned, but with all his nerves laid bare, as if he were flayed. Yes, his was a complicated, rich nature. Not such a... But where is the use of talking? He added with a vicious frown. Shall we first educate the people and then change the forms of life, or first change the forms and then struggle, using peaceful propaganda or terrorism? So we go on disputing while they kill. They do not dispute. They know their business. They don't care whether dozens, hundreds of men perish. And what men? No, that the best should perish is just what they want. Yes. Herzen said that when the Decembrists were withdrawn from circulation, the average level of our society sank. I should think so, indeed. Then Herzen himself and his fellows were withdrawn. Now is the turn of the Neverovs.
They can't all be got rid of, said Nabatov, in his cheerful tones. There will always be left enough to continue the breed.
No, there won't, if we show any pity to them there, Kryltsov said, raising his voice and not letting himself be interrupted. Give me a cigarette. Oh, Anatole, it is not good for you, said Mary Pavlovna. Please do not smoke. Oh, leave me alone, he said angrily, and lit a cigarette, but at once began to cough and to retch, as if he were going to be sick. Having cleared his throat, though, he went on, What we have been doing is not the thing at all, not to argue but for all to unite, to destroy them, that's it.
But they are also human beings, said Nekhludoff.
No, they are not human. They who can do what they are doing, no. There, now, I heard that some kind of bombs and balloons have been invented. Well, one ought to go up in such a balloon and sprinkle bombs down on them as if they were bugs, until they are all exterminated. Yes, because...
He was going to continue, but flushing all over, he began coughing worse than before, and a stream of blood rushed from his mouth. Nabatov ran to get ice. Mary Pavlovna brought valerian drops and offered them to him. But he, breathing quickly and heavily, pushed her away with his thin, white hand and kept his eyes closed. When the ice and cold water had eased Kryltzoff a little, and he had been put to bed, Nekhludov, having said good night to everybody, went out with a sergeant who had been waiting for him some time. The criminals were now quiet, and most of them were asleep. Though the people were lying on and under the bed-shelves and in the space between, they could not all be placed inside the rooms, and some of them lay in the passage with their sacks under their heads and covered with their cloaks. The moans and sleepy voices came through the open doors and sounded through the passage. Everywhere lay compact heaps of human beings covered with prison cloaks. Only a few men who were sitting in the bachelor's room by the light of a candle-end, which they put out when they noticed the sergeant, were awake, and an old man who sat naked under the lamp in the passage picking the vermin off his shirt. The foul air in the political prisoners' rooms seemed pure compared to the stinking closeness here. The smoking lamp shone dimly as through a mist, and it was difficult to breathe. Stepping along the passage, one had to look carefully for an empty space, and having put down one foot, had to find place for the other. Three persons, who had evidently found no room even in the passage, lay in the anteroom close to the stinking and leaking tub. One of these was an old idiot whom Nekhludov had often seen marching with the gang. Another was a boy of about 12. He lay between the two other convicts, with his head on the leg of one of them. When he had passed out of the gate, Nekhludov took a deep breath, and long continued to breathe in deep draughts of frosty air. Chapter 19. Why is it done? It had cleared up, and was starlight. Except in a few places, the mud was frozen hard when Nekhludov returned to his inn and knocked at one of its dark windows. The broad-shouldered labourer came barefooted to open the door for him and let him in. Through a door on the right, leading to the back premises, came the loud snoring of the carters who slept there, and the sound of many horses chewing oats came from the yard. The front room, where a red lamp was burning in front of the icons, smelt of wormwood and perspiration, and someone with mighty lungs was snoring behind a partition. Nekhludov undressed, put his leather travelling pillow on the oilcloth sofa, spread out his rug and lay down, thinking over all he had seen and heard that day. The boy sleeping on the liquid that oozed from the stinking tub, with his head on the convict's leg, seemed more dreadful than all else. Unexpected and important as his conversation with Simonson and Katyusha that evening had been, he did not dwell on it. His situation in relation to that subject was so complicated and indefinite that he drove the thought from his mind. But the picture of those unfortunate beings inhaling the noisome air and lying in the liquid oozing out of the stinking tub, especially that of the boy, with his innocent face asleep on the leg of a criminal, came all the more vividly to his mind, and he could not get it out of his head. To know that somewhere far away there are men who torture other men by inflicting all sorts of humiliations and inhuman degradation and sufferings on them, or for 3 months incessantly to look on while men were inflicting these humiliations and sufferings on other men, is a very different thing. And Nekhludov felt it. More than once during these 3 months he asked himself, "Am I mad because I see what others do not? Or are they mad that do these things that I see?" Yet they, and there were many of them, did what seemed so astonishing and terrible to him with such quiet assurance that what they were doing was necessary and was important and useful work that it was hard to believe they were mad. Nor could he, conscious of the clearness of his thoughts, believe he was mad, and all this kept him continually in a state of perplexity. This is how the things he saw during these 3 months impressed Nekhludov. From among the people who were free, those were chosen by means of trials and the administration who were the most nervous, the most hot-tempered, the most excitable, the most gifted and the strongest, but the least careful and cunning. These people, not a whit more dangerous than many of those who remained free, were first locked in prisons, transported to Siberia, where they were provided for and kept months and years in perfect idleness, and away from nature, their families, and useful work, that is, away from the conditions necessary for a natural and moral life. This firstly. Secondly, these people were subjected to all sorts of unnecessary indignity in these different places, chains, shaved heads, shameful clothing. That is, they were deprived of the chief motives that induce the weak to live good lives, the regard for public opinion, the sense of shame, and the consciousness of human dignity. Thirdly, they were continually exposed to dangers, such as the epidemics so frequent in places of confinement, exhaustion, flogging, not to mention accidents, such as sunstrokes, drowning, or conflagrations, when the instinct of self-preservation makes even the kindest, most moral men commit cruel actions, and excuse such actions when committed by others. Fourthly, these people were forced to associate with others who were particularly depraved by life, and especially by these very institutions, rakes, murderers, and villains, who act on those who are not yet corrupted by the measures inflicted on them as leaven acts on dough. And fifthly, the fact that all sorts of violence, cruelty, inhumanity are not only tolerated, but even permitted by the government when it suits its purposes, was impressed on them most forcibly by the inhuman treatment they were subjected to, by the sufferings inflicted on children, women, and old men, by floggings with rods and whips, by rewards offered for bringing a fugitive back, dead or alive, by the separation of husbands and wives, and the uniting them with the wives and husbands of others for sexual intercourse, by shooting or hanging them. To those who were deprived of their freedom, who were in want and misery, acts of violence were evidently still more permissible. All these institutions seemed purposely invented for the production of depravity and vice, condensed to such a degree that no other conditions could produce it, and for the spreading of this condensed depravity and vice broadcast among the whole population. Just as if a problem had been set to find the best, the surest means of depraving the greatest number of persons, thought Nekhludov, while investigating the deeds that were being done in the prisons and halting stations. Every year, hundreds of thousands were brought to the highest pitch of depravity, and when completely depraved, they were set free to carry the depravity they had caught in prison among the people, in the prisons of Taman, Ekaterinburg, Tomsk, and at the halting stations. Nekhludov saw how successfully the object society seemed to have set itself was attained. Ordinary, simple men, with a conception of the demands of the social and Christian Russian peasant morality, lost this conception and found a new one, founded chiefly on the idea that any outrage or violence was justifiable if it seemed profitable. After living in a prison, those people became conscious with the whole of their being that, judging by what was happening to themselves, all the moral laws, the respect and the sympathy for others which church and the moral teachers preach, was really set aside, and that, therefore, they too need not keep the laws. Nekhludov noticed the effects of prison life on all the convicts he knew, on Fyodorov, on Makar, and even on Taras, who, after 2 months among the convicts, struck Nekhludov by the want of morality in his arguments. Nekhludov found out during his journey how tramps, escaping into the marshes, persuade a comrade to escape with them, and then kill him and feed on his flesh. He saw a living man who was accused of this, and acknowledged the fact. And the most terrible part was that this was not a solitary, but a recurring case. Only by a special cultivation of vice, such as was perpetrated in these establishments, could a Russian be brought to the state of this tramp, who excelled Nietzsche's newest teaching, and held that everything was possible and nothing forbidden, and who spread this teaching first among the convicts and then among the people in general. The only explanation of all that was being done was the wish to put a stop to crime by fear, by correction, by lawful vengeance, as it was written in the books. But in reality, nothing in the least resembling any of these results came to pass. Instead of vice being put a stop to, it only spread further. Instead of being frightened, the criminals were encouraged. Many a tramp returned to prison of his own free will. Instead of being corrected, every kind of vice was systematically instilled, while the desire for vengeance did not weaken by the measures of the government, but was bred in the people who had none of it. "Then why is it done?" Nekhludov asked himself, but could find no answer. And what seemed most surprising was that all this was not being done accidentally, not by mistake, not once, but that it had continued for centuries, with this difference only, that at first the people's nostrils used to be torn and their ears cut off. Then they were branded, and now they were manacled and transported by steam instead of on the old carts. The arguments brought forward by those in government service, who said that the things which aroused his indignation were simply due to the imperfect arrangements of the places of confinement, and that they could all be put to rights if prisons of a modern type were built, did not satisfy Nekhludov, because he knew that what revolted him was not the consequence of a better or worse arrangement of the prisons. He had read of model prisons with electric bells, of executions by electricity, recommended by Tartt. But this refined kind of violence revolted him even more. But what revolted Nekhludov most was that there were men in the law courts and in the ministry who received large salaries taken from the people for referring to books written by men like themselves and with like motives, and sorting actions that violated laws made by themselves according to different statutes, and, in obedience to these statutes, sending those guilty of such actions to places where they were completely at the mercy of cruel, hardened inspectors, jailers, convoy soldiers, where millions of them perished, body and soul. Now that he had a closer knowledge of prisons, Nekhludov found out that all those vices which developed among the prisoners, drunkenness, gambling, cruelty, and all these terrible crimes, even cannibalism, were not casual, or due to degeneration, or to the existence of monstrosities of the criminal type, as science going hand in hand with the government explained it, but an unavoidable consequence of the incomprehensible delusion that men may punish one another. Nekhludov saw that cannibalism did not commence in the marshes, but in the ministry. He saw that his brother-in-law, for example, and in fact all the lawyers and officials, from the usher to the minister, do not care in the least for justice or the good of the people about whom they spoke, but only for the roubles they were paid for doing the things that were the source whence all this degradation and suffering flowed. This was quite evident. Can it be, then, that all this is done simply through misapprehension? Could it not be managed that all these officials should have their salaries secured to them, and a premium paid them, besides, so that they should leave off doing all that they were doing now? Nekhludov thought, and in spite of the fleas that seemed to spring up round him like water from a fountain whenever he moved, he fell fast asleep. Chapter 20. The Journey Resumed. The carters had left the inn long before Nekhludov awoke. The landlady had had her tea and came in wiping her fat, perspiring neck with her handkerchief, and said that a soldier had brought a note from the halting station. The note was from Mary Pavlovna. She wrote that Kryltsov's attack was more serious than they had imagined. "We wished him to be left behind and to remain with him, but this has not been allowed, so that we shall take him on, but we fear the worst. Please arrange so that if he should be left in the next town, one of us might remain with him. If in order to get the permission to stay I should be obliged to get married to him, I am of course ready to do so." Nekhludov sent the young labourer to the post-station to order horses, and began packing up, hurriedly. Before he had drunk his second tumbler of tea, the three-horsed post-cart drove up to the porch with ringing bells, the wheels rattling on the frozen mud as on stones. Nekhludov paid the fat-necked landlady, hurried out and got into the cart, and gave orders to the driver to go on as fast as possible, so as to overtake the gang. Just past the gates of the commune pasture ground they did overtake the carts, loaded with sacks and the sick prisoners, as they rattled over the frozen mud that was just beginning to be rolled smooth by the wheels. The officer was not there. He had gone in advance. The soldiers, who had evidently been drinking, followed by the side of the road, chatting merrily. There were a great many carts. In each of the first carts sat six invalid criminal convicts, close-packed. On each of the last two were three political prisoners. Novodvorov, Grabets, and Kondratyev sat on one, Rintzeva, Nabatov, and the woman to whom Mary Pavlovna had given up her own place on the other, and on one of the carts lay Kryltsov, on a heap of hay, with a pillow under his head, and Mary Pavlovna sat by him on the edge of the cart. Nekhludov ordered his driver to stop, got out, and went up to Kryltsov. One of the tipsy soldiers waved his hand towards Nekhludov, but he paid no attention and started walking by Kryltsov's side, holding on to the side of the cart with his hand. Dressed in a sheepskin coat, with a fur cap on his head and his mouth bound up with a handkerchief, he seemed paler and thinner than ever. His beautiful eyes looked very large and brilliant. Shaken from side to side by the joltings of the cart, he lay with his eyes fixed on Nekhludov. But when asked about his health, he only closed his eyes and angrily shook his head. All his energy seemed to be needed in order to bear the jolting of the cart. Mary Pavlovna was on the other side. She exchanged a significant glance with Nekhludov, which expressed all her anxiety about Kryltzoff's state, and then began to talk at once in a cheerful manner.
"It seems the officer is ashamed of himself," she shouted, so as to be heard above the rattle of the wheels. "Busovkin's manacles have been removed, and he is carrying his little girl himself. Katyusha and Simonson are with him, and Vera, too. She has taken my place."
Kryltzoff said something that could not be heard because of the noise, and frowning in the effort to repress his cough, shook his head. Then Nekhludov stooped towards him so as to hear, and Kryltzoff, freeing his mouth of the handkerchief, whispered,
"Much better now, only not to catch cold."
Nekhludov nodded in acquiescence, and again exchanged a glance with Mary Pavlovna.
"How about the problem of the three bodies?" whispered Kryltzoff, smiling with great difficulty. "The solution is difficult."
Nekhludov did not understand, but Mary Pavlovna explained that he meant the well-known mathematical problem which defined the position of the sun, moon, and earth, which Kryltzoff compared to the relations between Nekhludov, Katyusha, and Simonson. Kryltzoff nodded to show that Mary Pavlovna had explained his joke correctly. "The decision does not lie with me," Nekhludov said.
"Did you get my note? Will you do it?" Mary Pavlovna asked.
"Certainly," answered Nekhludov, and noticing a look of displeasure on Kryltzoff's face, he returned to his conveyance, and holding with both hands to the sides of the cart, got in, which jolted with him over the ruts of the rough road. He passed the gang, which, with its grey cloaks and sheepskin coats, chains and manacles, stretched over 3/4 of a mile of the road. On the opposite side of the road, Nekhludov noticed Katyusha's blue shawl, Vera Dukhova's black coat, and Simonson's crochet cap, white worsted stockings, with bands, like those of sandals, tied round him. Simonson was walking with a woman and carrying on a heated discussion. When they saw Nekhludov, they bowed to him, and Simonson raised his hat in a solemn manner. Nekhludov, having nothing to say, did not stop, and was soon ahead of the carts. Having got again onto a smoother part of the road, they drove still more quickly, but they had continually to turn aside to let pass long rows of carts that were moving along the road in both directions. The road, which was cut up by deep ruts, lay through a thick pine forest, mingled with birch trees and larches, bright with yellow leaves they had not yet shed. By the time Nekhludov had passed about half the gang, he reached the end of the forest. Fields now lay stretched along both sides of the road, and the crosses and cupolas of a monastery appeared in the distance. The clouds had dispersed, and it had cleared up completely. The leaves, the frozen puddles, and the gilt crosses and cupolas of the monastery glittered brightly in the sun that had risen above the forest. A little to the right, mountains began to gleam white in the blue-grey distance, and the trap entered a large village. The village street was full of people, both Russians and other nationalities, wearing peculiar caps and cloaks. Tipsy men and women crowded and chattered round booths, traktirs, public houses and carts. The vicinity of a town was noticeable. Giving a pull and a lash of the whip to the horse on his right, the driver sat down sideways on the right edge of the seat, so that the reins hung over that side, and with evident desire of showing off, he drove quickly down to the river, which had to be crossed by a ferry. The raft was coming towards them and had reached the middle of the river. About 20 carts were waiting to cross. Nekhludov had not long to wait. The raft, which had been pulled far up the stream, quickly approached the landing, carried by the swift waters. The tall, silent, broad-shouldered, muscular ferryman, dressed in sheepskins, threw the ropes and moored the raft with practised hand, landed the carts that were on it, and put those that were waiting on the bank on board. The whole raft was filled with vehicles and horses, shuffling at the sight of the water. The broad, swift river splashed against the sides of the ferryboats, tightening their moorings. When the raft was full, and Nekhludov's cart, with the horses taken out of it, stood closely surrounded by other carts on the side of the raft. The ferryman barred the entrance, and, paying no heed to the prayers of those who had not found room in the raft, unfastened the ropes and set off. All was quiet on the raft. One could hear nothing but the tramp of the ferryman's boots and the horses changing from foot to foot. Chapter 21. Just a Worthless Tramp. Nekhludov stood on the edge of the raft, looking at the broad river. Two pictures kept rising up in his mind. One, that of Kryltzoff, unprepared for death and dying, made a heavy, sorrowful impression on him. The other, that of Katyusha, full of energy, having gained the love of such a man as Simonson, and found a true and solid path towards righteousness, should have been pleasant. Yet it also created a heavy impression on Nekhludov's mind, and he could not conquer this impression. The vibrating sounds of a big brass bell reached them from the town. Nekhludov's driver, who stood by his side, and the other men on the raft, raised their caps and crossed themselves. All except a short, dishevelled old man who stood close to the railway, and whom Nekhludov had not noticed before. He did not cross himself, but raised his head and looked at Nekhludov. This old man wore a patched coat, cloth trousers, and worn and patched shoes. He had a small wallet on his back, and a high fur cap with a fur much rubbed on his head.
"Why don't you pry, old chap?"
asked Nekhludov's driver as he replaced and straightened his cap.
"Are you unbaptized?"
"Who's one to pray to?"
asked the old man quickly, in a determinately aggressive tone.
"To whom? To God, of course," said the driver sarcastically. "And you just show me where he is, that God!"
There was something so serious and firm in the expression of the old man that the driver felt that he had to do with a strong-minded man, and was a bit abashed. And trying not to show this, not to be silenced, and not to be put to shame before the crowd that was observing them, he answered quickly,
"Where? In heaven, of course. And have you been up there?"
"Whether I've been or not, everyone knows that you must pray to God. No one has ever seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, he hath declared him,"
said the old man in the same rapid manner, and with a severe frown on his brow.
"It's clear that you're not a Christian, but a hole worshipper. You pray to a hole," said the driver, shoving the handle of his whip into his girdle, pulling straight the harness on one of the horses.
Someone laughed.
"What is your faith, Dad?"
asked a middle-aged man, who stood by his cart on the same side of the raft.
"I have no kind of faith, because I believe no one, no one but myself,"
said the old man as quickly and decidedly as before.
"How can you believe yourself?"
Nekhludov asked, entering into a conversation with him.
"You might make a mistake."
"Never in your life,"
the old man said decidedly, with a toss of his head.
"Then why are there different faiths?"
Nekhludov asked.
"It's just because men believe others and do not believe themselves that there are different faiths. I also believed others, and lost myself, as in a swamp, lost myself so that I had no hope of finding my way out. Old believers and new believers, and Judaizers, and Klisti, and Popovitsi, and Bezpopovitsi, and Avstriaks, and Molokans, and Skupzi. Every faith praises itself only, and so they all creep about like blind puppies. There are many faiths, but the Spirit is one, in me, and in you, and in him. So that if everyone believes himself, all will be united. Everyone he himself, and all will be as one.